Dead rats, blocked toilets, shit on the wall. He shudders. But it was the best decision I ever made. You would not believe how much the place is worth now. Laurel could believe it, having sold her own Stroud greenhouse only a few years earlier. Do you think you'll ever go back to the States? He shakes his head. No, never. It was never home to me. Nowhere ever felt like home to me till I came here. And your parents? Are they still alive?
Yup, very much so.
They were young parents, so they're still pretty spry. What about you? He asks. Are your parents still with you? She shakes her head. My dad died when I was 26. My mom's in a home now. She's very frail. I doubt she'll be around this time next year. Then she smiles and says, In fact, it was her who told me to call you. On Sunday. She can barely talk. It takes her an age to form a sentence. Usually all she wants to talk about is dying. But she told me to call you. She said it was fantastic that I'd met you. She literally put my phone in my hand. It's the most... She glances down at her lap. The most maternal thing she's done in a decade. The most human thing she's done in months. It moved me. And then Floyd reaches across the table and places his hands over hers, his nice grey eyes fixed on hers. And he says, God bless your glorious mum. She hooks her fingers over his and squeezes his hands gently. His touch feels both gentle and hard, sexual yet benign. His touch makes her feel everything she thought she'd never feel again, things she'd forgotten she'd ever felt in the first place. His thumbs move up her wrists and pass over her pulse points. His fingertips draw lines up and down the insides of her arms. She pulls at the soft hair on his forearms and then pushes her hands deep inside the soft wool of his sleeves. She finds his elbows and his hands find hers, and they grasp each other like that, across the table, for a long, intense moment, before slowly pulling apart. And they ask for the bill. His house is exactly the same as her old house, just three roads down from where she used to live. It's a semi-detached Victorian with Dutch gables and a small balcony over the front porch. It has a tiled path leading to a front door with stained glass panels to each side and a stained glass fanlight above. There is a small square of a front garden, neatly tended, and a pair of wheelie bins down the side return. Laurel knows what the house will look like on the inside before Floyd even has his key in the front door, because it will look just like hers. And yes, there it is, as she'd known it would be, the tiled hallway with a wide staircase ahead, the banister ending in a generous swirl, a single wooden step leading down to a large, airy kitchen, and a door to the left through which she can make out a book-lined room, the flicker of a TV set, and a pair of bare feet crossed at the ankle. She watches the bare feet uncross and lower themselves to the stripped floorboards. Then a face appears, a small, nervous face, a shock of white blonde hair, a crescent of multiple earrings, a thick flick of blue liner. Dad? The head retracts quickly at the sight of Laurel in the hallway. Hi, honey. Floyd turns and mouths, Sarah, at Laurel, before popping his head around the door. How's your evening been? Okay. Sarah Jade's voice is soft and deep. How was Poppy? She was okay. What time did she go to bed? Oh, like half an hour ago. You're early. Laurel sees the delicate head lean forward slightly, then snap back again. Sarah? Floyd turns to Laurel and gestures for her hand.
I've got someone to introduce you to.
He pulls Laurel toward the door and propels her in front of him.
This is Laurel. Laurel, this is my eldest daughter, Sarah Jade.
S.J., says the tiny girl on the armchair, slowly pulling herself to her feet. She gives Laurel a tiny hand to shake and says, Nice to meet you. Then she falls back into the armchair and curls her tiny blue-veined feet beneath her. She's wearing an oversized black T-shirt and black velvet leggings. Laurel takes in the thinness of her, wonders if it is an eating disorder or just the way she's built. On the television is a reality TV show about people having blind dates in a brightly lit restaurant. On the floor by SJ's feet is an empty plate smeared with traces of tomato ketchup and an empty Diet Coke can. Crumpled on the arm of the chair is a wrapper from a Galaxy bar. Laurel assumes then that her build is all natural and immediately pictures her mother, some tremulous pixie woman with enormous eyes and size 6 jeans. She feels pathetically jealous for a moment.
Well, says Floyd, we'll be in the kitchen. Do you want a cup of tea?
Sarah Jade shakes her head, but doesn't say anything. Laurel follows Floyd into the kitchen. It's as she'd imagined. Smart cream wooden units with oversized wooden knobs, a dark green range, an island surrounded by stools. Unlike her old kitchen, it hasn't been extended into the return, but just to the back, where there is a pine table surrounded by pine chairs, piles of paper and magazines, two laptops, a pink fur coat slung over one chair, a suit jacket over the other. She sits on a stool and watches him make her a mug of chamomile tea. Himself, a coffee from a filter machine.
Your house is lovely, she says.
Why, thank you, he replies. Although I feel you should know that that exact spot where you're sitting was where the guy who used to live in the back room kept his chamber pot. And I know that because he left it behind when he moved out. Unemptied.
Oh my God, she laughs. That's revolting.
Tell me about it.
You know, your house is the same as my old house.
Exactly. I mean, not exactly, obviously, but the same layout, the same design. All these streets, he said. All these houses. They were modern estates once upon a time, built at the same time to house the city workers.
He passes her her tea and smiles.
Strange, he says, to think that one day our ancestors might be charmed by a Barrett estate, desperately trying to preserve the period features.
Don't touch that plastic coving. It's priceless.
Laurel smiles.
Can you believe the people who lived here before took out the fitted wardrobes with mirrored sliding doors?
Floyd laughs and eyes her fondly. And then he stops laughing and stares at her intently.
He says, You know, I googled you after our first date.
The smile freezes on Laurel's face.
I know about Ellie.
Laurel grips her mug between her hands and swallows.
Oh.
You knew I would, didn't you?
She smiles sadly.
Oh, I don't know. I suppose it occurred to me. I would have said something. Soon. I was on the verge. It just didn't seem like first date kind of fodder.
No, he says softly. I get that.
She turns the mug around and around, not sure where to head next with this development.
I'm really sorry, he says. I just...
He sighs heavily.
I wouldn't... I can't imagine. Well, I can imagine. I can imagine all too well. Which makes it hard to bear. Not that me bearing it is of any relevance to anything, But the thought of you and your girl, it's just... Christ.
He sighs heavily.
And I wanted to say something all night, because it felt so dishonest to sit there making small talk with you when I had all this knowledge and you didn't know I had and...
I'm an idiot, she says. I should have guessed.
No,
he says.
I'm an idiot. I should have waited for you to tell me, when you were ready.
And Laurel smiles and looks up at Floyd, into his misty eyes. Then she looks down at his hands, the hands that just caressed her arms so seductively in the restaurant. And she looks around his warm, loved home. And she says, I'm ready now. I can talk about it now. He reaches across the counter and places his hand upon her shoulder. She instinctively rubs her cheek against it.
Are you sure?
Yes, she says. I'm sure. It is nearly 1 a.m. when Floyd finally leads Laurel up the stairs to his bedroom. Sarah Jade had taken a taxi home at midnight, saying goodbye to her father in hushed tones and without acknowledging Laurel. Floyd's room is painted dark burgundy and hung with interesting abstract oil paintings he claims to have found in the basement of the house when he was renovating it.
They're kind of ugly, I guess, but I like them. I like that I liberated them from total obscurity, let them live and breathe.
Where's Poppy's room? She whispers. He points above and behind.
She won't hear anything. And besides, she sleeps like the dead.
And then he is unzipping the back of her pinafore dress, and she is tugging at the sleeves of his warm, soft jumper. And they are a tangle of limbs and clothes and tights, and despite the fact that Laurel had decided a long time ago that she and sex were over, 5 minutes later, it is happening. She is having sex. And not only that, but it is the best sex she has ever had in her life. And within moments of doing it, she wants to do it all over again. They fall asleep as a dull brown dawn creeps through the gaps in his curtains, wrapped up in each other's arms. Chapter 17.
Morning. Are you Laurel?
Laurel jumps slightly. It's 10 o'clock, and she'd assumed that Floyd's daughter would have been at school by now.
Yes,
she says, flicking on a warm smile.
Yes, I'm Laurel.
And you're Poppy, I assume?
Yes, I am Poppy.
She beams at Laurel, revealing crooked teeth and a small dimple in her left cheek. And Laurel has to hold on to something then, the closest thing to her, the doorframe. She grips it hard, and for a moment, she is rendered entirely mute.
Wow, she says eventually. Sorry, you look...
But she doesn't say it. She doesn't say, you look just like my lost girl. The dimple, the broad forehead, the heavy-lidded eyes. The way you tip your head to one side like that when you're trying to work out what someone's thinking. Instead, she says,
You remind me of someone. Sorry.
And she laughs too loud. Laurel used to see girls who looked like Ellie all the time after she'd first gone. She'd never quite got to the point of chasing anyone down the street, calling out her daughter's name and grabbing them by the shoulder as people did in movies. But she'd had the butterflies, the quickening of her breath, the feeling that her world was about to blow apart with joy and relief. They were always so short-lived, those moments, and it hadn't happened for years now. Poppy smiles and says,
Can I get you anything? A tea? A coffee?
Oh, says Laurel, not expecting such slick hostessing from a 9-year-old girl.
Yes, A coffee, please, if that's okay. She looks behind her to see if Floyd is coming. He told her he would be down in 2 minutes. He hadn't told her that his daughter would be here.
Dad said you were really pretty,
says Poppy, with her back to her as she fills the filter machine from the tap.
And you are.
Gosh, says Laurel. Thank you. Though, I must look a state. She runs her hand down her hair, smoothing out the tangles that this child's father put there last night with his hands. She's wearing Floyd's T-shirt, and she reeks. She knows she does. Of sex.
Did you have a lovely evening?
Poppy asks, spooning ground coffee into the machine. Yes. Thank you, we really did.
Did you go to the Eritrean place?
Yes.
That's my favourite restaurant, she says. My dad's been taking me there since I was tiny.
Oh, says Laurel. What a sophisticated palate you must have.
There's nothing I won't eat, she replies. Apart from prunes, which are the devil's work.
Poppy is wearing a loose-fitting dress made of blue and white striped cotton, with navy woolen tights and a pair of navy leather pumps. Her brown hair is tied back and has two small red clips in it. It's a very formal outfit for a young girl, Laurel feels. The sort of thing she'd have had to bribe both her girls to wear when they were that age. No school today? She inquires.
No. No school any day. I don't go to school.
Oh, says Laurel. That's... I mean...
Dad teaches me.
Has he always taught you?
Yes, always. You know, I could read chapter books when I was 3. Simple algebra at 4. There was no normal school that would have coped with me, really.
She laughs, a womanly tinkle, and she flicks the switch on the filter machine.
Can I interest you in some granola and yogurt? Maybe? Or a slice of toast?
Laurel turns to look behind her again. There's still no sign of Floyd. You know, she says, I might just have a quick shower before I eat anything. I feel a bit... She grimaces. I won't be long.
Absolutely, says Poppy. You go and shower. I'll have your coffee waiting for you.
Laurel nods and smiles and starts to back out of the kitchen. She passes Floyd on the stairs. He's fresh and showered, his hair damp and combed back off his face, his skin uncooked-looking where he shaved away yesterday's stubble. He encircles her waist with his arm and buries his face in her shoulder. I met Poppy, she says quietly. You didn't tell me you homeschooled her.
Didn't I?
No. She pulls away from another attempt at affection. I'm going to have a shower, she says. I can't sit chatting to your daughter, smelling like an old slapper who's been up all night shagging her dad.
Floyd laughs. You smell delicious, he says, and his hand goes between her legs, and she's torn between pressing herself hard against it and slapping it away.
Stop it, she says affectionately, and he laughs.
What did you think, he says, of my Poppy?
She's charming, she says. Totally delightful.
He glows at the words. Isn't she just? Isn't she just magnificent?
He leans down and he kisses her gently on the lips, before descending the stairs and heading into the kitchen where Laurel hears him greeting his daughter with the words,
Good morning, my remarkable girl. And how are you? Today.
She continues up the stairs and takes a long, slow shower in her lover's ensuite bathroom, feeling a peculiarity and wrongness that she cannot quite locate the cause of. Later that day, Laurel goes to Hannah's flat to clean it. Other people might find the £30 pinioned beneath a vase of flowers on the table slightly peculiar. Laurel is aware that being paid in cash to clean her daughter's flat is not entirely normal. But all families have their idiosyncrasies, and this is just one of theirs. As it is, every week she puts the £30 into a special bank account that she will one day use to spoil her as-yet-unborn grandchildren with treats and days out. She folds up the notes and slots them into her purse. Then she does the detective sweep of Hannah's flat that she has begun to do since Hannah stopped sleeping here every night. She remains unconvinced by Hannah's explanation of late nights and sleepovers, this sudden rush of parties and good times. That is simply not the daughter she knows. Hannah has never liked having fun. The flowers are of particular interest. Not a hastily bought bunch of Sainsbury's tulips or stargazer lilies, but a bouquet. Dusky roses, baby's breath, lilac hyacinths, and eucalyptus. The stems are still spiraled together in the middle, where the twine would have tied them together. In the kitchen, she takes out the cleaning products and eyes the work surfaces, looking for clues. Hannah was not home the night before, as evidenced once again by the lack of cereal bowl and makeup detritus. The problem, Laurel can see, is that if there is a man, then Hannah is spending all her time at his house, so there will be no evidence to find at her house. She sighs and leans down to the swing bin to pull out the half-full bag, which, as always, weighs nothing, as Hannah has no life. She scrunches it down to tie the top in a knot and notices the crackle of cellophane. Quickly, she puts her hand into the bag and locates the flower packaging. She pulls it out and unfurls it, and there is a tiny card taped to it, a message scrawled on it in scruffy florist's handwriting. "Can't wait to see you tomorrow. Please don't be late. I love you so much. T. Kiss." Laurel holds the card between her thumb and forefinger and stares at it for a while. Then she shoves it back into the bin bag and ties a knot in it. "There," she thinks. "There it is. Hannah has moved on. Hannah has a man." But why, she wonders. Is she not talking to me about it? Chapter 18. Laurel has not seen Paul since Ellie's funeral. There they had stood side by side. Paul had not brought Bonnie, and had not even asked if he could. Yes, he is a good man. A good man in every way. He had held her up that day when she felt her legs weaken slightly beneath her at the sight of the box going through the curtains to the sound of "Somewhere Only We Know" by Keen. He'd passed her cups of tea at his mother's house afterward and then found her in a corner of the garden and lured her back into the house with the promise of a large Baileys and ice, her all-time favourite treat. They'd sat together after everyone else had gone and rolled the ice around the insides of their glasses and made each other laugh. And Laurel's feelings had warped and contorted and turned into something both light and dark, golden and grey. He hadn't once checked his phone or worried about being late for Bonnie. And they'd left his mother's house together at 10 o'clock, weaving slightly toward the minicabs that rumbled and growled on the street outside. She let him hold her deep inside his arms, her face pressed hard against his chest, the clean, familiar smell of him, the softness of his old German street shirt. And she'd almost, almost, turned her face toward him and kissed him. She'd woken the following day feeling as though her world had been upended and reordered in every conceivable way. And she hadn't spoken to him since. But now she feels as though all that ambiguity has melted away. She is a clean slate, and she can face him once more. So when she gets back from Hannah's flat, she calls him. "Hello, Laurel," he says warmly, because Paul says everything warmly. It's one of the many things that made her hate him during Ellie's missing years. The way he'd smile so genuinely at the police and the reporters and the journalists and the nosy neighbours, the way he'd reach out to people with both of his warm hands and hold theirs inside his, keeping eye contact, asking after their health, playing down their own nightmare, trying, constantly, to make everyone feel better about everything all the time. She, meanwhile, had pictured herself with her hands around his soft throat, squeezing and squeezing, until he was dead. But now his tone matches her own state of mind. Now she can appreciate him afresh. Lovely, lovely, Paul Mack. Such a nice man.
"How are you?"
he says. "I'm fine, thank you," she says. "How are you?"
"Oh, you know."
She does know. "I wondered," she began. "It's mine and Hannah's birthday next week. I was thinking maybe we could do something. Together? Maybe?" Hannah had arrived in the world at 2 minutes past midnight on Laurel's 27th birthday. It was family law that she'd been born determined to steal everyone's limelight.
"You mean all of us? You, me, the kids?"
"Yes. Kids. Partners too, if you like."
"Wow. Yes."
He sounds like a small boy being offered a free bicycle.
"I think that's a great idea. It's Wednesday, isn't it?"
"Yes. And I haven't asked her yet. It's possible she may be busy. But I just thought, after the year we've had, after, you know, finding Ellie, saying goodbye, we've been so fractured for so long, maybe now it's time to..."
"To come back together,"
he cuts in.
"It's a brilliant idea. I'd love to. I'll talk to Bonnie."
"Well," she says, "wait till I've spoken to the kids. It's hard, you know, they're so busy. But fingers crossed."
"Yes, definitely. Thank you, Laurel."
"You're welcome."
"It's been a long journey, hasn't it?"
"Arduous."
"I've missed you so much."
"I've missed you too. And Paul," he says.
"Yes?"
She pauses for a moment, swallows hard, and then reaches down into herself to retrieve the word she never thought she'd say to Paul. "I'm sorry."
"What on earth for?"
"Oh, you know, Paul. You don't have to pretend. I was a bitch to you. You know I was."
"Laurel."
He sighs.
"You were never a bitch."
"No," she says. "I was worse than a bitch."
"You were never anything other than a mother, Laurel. That's all."
Other mothers lose children without losing their husbands, too.
"You didn't lose me, Laurel. I'm still yours. I'll always be yours."
"Well, that's not strictly true, is it?" He sighs again.
"Where it counts,"
he says.
"As the father of your children, as a friend, as someone who shared a journey with you, and as someone who loves you and cares about you. I don't need to be married to you to be all those things. Those things are deeper than marriage. Those things are forever."
Now Laurel sighs, an awkward smile twisting the corners of her mouth. "Thank you, Paul. Thank you." She hangs up a moment later, and she holds her phone in her lap for a while, tenderly, staring straight ahead, feeling a sense of peace she never thought would be hers to feel again.
Hannah sounds annoyed even to be asked about it. "What do you mean, all of us?"
she asks. "I mean me, you, Dad, Jake, Bonnie, Blue."
"Oh, God,"
she groans. Laurel stands firm. She'd known Hannah wouldn't leap headfirst into the concept.
Like you said, she explains. It's time for us all to move on. We're all healing now, and this is part of the process.
Well, for you, maybe. I mean, you've never even met Bonnie. How awkward is that going to be?
It won't be awkward because me and your father won't let it be awkward. How long had it been since she'd used those words? Me and your father. We're all grown-ups now, Hannah. No more excuses. You're almost 28.
I'm virtually an OAP.
We've buried Ellie. Your father has a partner. He loves her. I have to accept that and embrace her as part of this family. The same with Jake and Blue. And, of course, with you.
With me?
Yes. You. And whoever sent you those beautiful flowers. There's a cool beat of silence. Then...
What flowers?
The bouquet on your kitchen table.
There is no bouquet.
Oh, well, then the imaginary bouquet with the imaginary pink roses in it. That one. Hannah tuts.
That's not a bouquet. It's just a bunch. I bought them for myself.
Laurel sighs. Oh, she says breezily, disingenuously. My mistake, then. Sorry.
Will you just stop trying to invent a boyfriend for me, Mum? There is no boyfriend. Okay?
Fine. Yes.
Sorry. And I really don't like the idea of this big family meal. It's too bizarre.
Are you free? She pauses before she replies.
No.
No?
Well, not on my actual birthday. On our birthday, no. But I could do another day next week.
What are you doing on our actual birthday, then?
Oh, you know, just drinks after work. Nothing special.
Laurel blinks slowly. She knows her daughter is lying. That tea is taking her out somewhere special. But she says nothing. Well then, she says measuredly. How about the Friday?
Fine,
says Hannah.
Fine. But if it's all a hideous disaster, I'll blame you for the rest of my life.
Laurel smiles. As if that was anything new. Laurel arranges to see Floyd again on Thursday night. She didn't need to fret and simmer this time. He'd texted her within half an hour of her leaving his house on Wednesday morning. That was the best date I've ever been on. And Poppy loves you. Could I see you again? Please? Tomorrow? It had arrived on her phone as the tube burst out of the tunnel and into the daylight at East Finchley. She'd sucked her smile deep inside herself and texted back. Maybe. Unless... dot, dot, dot. She asked him if he'd like to come to her flat for dinner. He said that would be lovely. He'd ask SJ to sleep over at his. And now she is shopping for that dinner, alarmed and exhilarated by the litany of choices she is having to make. For so long she has done everything by rote, out of necessity. She has eaten the same meals, cooked from the same ingredients, that she has picked up in the same aisles. All her meals are roughly calorie controlled. 300 for breakfast, 400 for lunch, and 300 for dinner. Enough left over for a chocolate bar or some biscuits at work. 2 glasses of wine at the tail end of the day. That is how she views food. As calories. She stopped cooking for Paul and the kids the day Ellie disappeared. Slowly they'd finished the contents of the fridge, and then the freezer. And then at some point, Paul and Hannah had gone to Asda and filled a giant trolley to the brim with staples. Pasta, canned fish, sausages, frozen meat. And Paul had,
without any form of official handover or agreement, taken over the kitchen. And, God bless him, he was a terrible cook. No sense of taste, no idea about balanced meals. But the bland, well-intentioned food had appeared, and the family had eaten, and no one got rickets or died of malnutrition, and that was all that mattered, she supposed. But now she has to cook a meal for a man she's had sex with, a man she would be having sex with again, a man who took his daughter to an Eritrean restaurant when she was a toddler. And she feels completely out of her depth. She's clutching a computer printout of a Jamie Oliver recipe for jambalaya. Rice. How hard can it be? She collects peppers, onions, chicken, chorizo. But it's the other elements that throw her. Nibbles. Aperitifs. Puddings. Wine. She has no idea. None. She piles her trolley with strange-sounding crisps made out of pita bread and lentils, then throws in some Walker's Ready Salted, just to be safe. Then tubs of taramasalata, hummus, tzatziki, all of which she throws back when she realizes that they didn't go with the main course. But what does go with jambalaya? What do they nibble on in Louisiana before dinner? She has no idea, and picks up a Tex-Mex dip selection pack, which feels like something a student might buy for a house party. She covers all her bases for pudding. He's American, so she chooses a New York-style cheesecake, but he's also an Anglophile, so she picks up a sticky toffee pudding, too. But what if he's too full for pudding? What if he doesn't like pudding? She buys a box of after-eight mints, imagining some kind of, well, you're not really English until you've eaten an after-eight mint type of conversation. And then finally she pays for everything and loads it all into the back of her car with a sigh of relief. Her flat is another hurdle to cross. It's fine, essentially. She's neither messy nor tidy. Her flat is usually only a 10-minute runaround with a vacuum and bin bag away from looking perfectly presentable. But it's the lack of personality that worries her. Her flat is smart, but soulless. Shiny, new, low-ceilinged, small-windowed, featureless. She'd let her children take most of the things from the old house. She'd given a lot to charity, too. She'd brought the bare minimum with her. She regrets that now. It was as though she'd thought she'd be here for only a short time. As though she thought that she would just fade away here until there was nothing left of her. She showers and shaves and buffs and plucks. She cooks in her pajamas to save her clothes, and she finds the process of chopping and weighing and measuring and checking and tasting and stirring more enjoyable than she'd expected. And she remembers that she used to do this. She used to do this every day. Cook interesting, tasty, healthy meals. Every day. Sometimes twice a day. She'd cooked for her family, to show them that she loved them, to keep them healthy, to keep them safe. And then her daughter had disappeared, and then reappeared as a small selection of bones, and the body that Laurel had spent almost 16 years nurturing had been picked apart by wild animals and scattered across a damp forest floor. And all of those things had happened in spite of all the lovely food Laurel had cooked for her. So really, what was the point? But she is remembering now. Cooking doesn't just nurture the recipient. It nurtures the chef. At 7 o'clock, she gets dressed. A black sleeveless shirt and a full red skirt and, as she's not leaving the house and won't have to walk in them, a pair of red stilettos. At 7:15, her phone pings. Disaster. SJ blown us out. Can either come with Poppy or reschedule. Your call. She breathes in deeply. Her initial reaction is annoyance. Intense annoyance. All the effort. All the hair removal. Not to mention the changing of her bedsheets. but the feeling passes, and she thinks, actually, why not? Why not spend an evening with Floyd and his daughter? Why not take the opportunity to get to know her a bit better? And besides, the bedsheets needed changing. She smiles and texts back. Please come with Poppy. It would be an absolute pleasure. Floyd replies immediately. That's fantastic. Thank you. One small thing, she's obsessed with other people's photos. If you have any of Ellie, maybe best to put them away. I haven't told her about Ellie and think it's best she doesn't know. Hope that's okay. Smiley face. Chapter 19. Poppy is wearing a knee-length black velvet dress with a red bolero jacket and red shoes with bows on them, and Laurel feels another jolt of unease about the way the girl is dressed. It screams of lack of peer influence and a mother's touch. But she puts the unease to one side and brings Floyd and Poppy into her living room, where candles flicker and cast dancing shadows on the plain white walls, where bowls of crisps and Tex-Mex dips decanted into glass dishes sit on the coffee table, where soft background music blunts the hard edges of the small square room, and where a bottle of Cava sits in a cooler and glasses sparkle in the candlelight. What a lovely flat, says Floyd, passing her a bottle of wine and prompting Poppy to pass her the bunch of lilies she'd been clutching when she arrived. It's okay, says Laurel. It's functional. Poppy looks around for a moment, taking in the family photos on the windowsills and the cabinets. Is this your little girl? She says, peering at a photo of Hannah when she was about 6 or 7. Yes, says Laurel. That's Hannah. She's not a little girl anymore, though. She's going to be 28 next week. And is this your son? Yes. That's Jake, my oldest one. He'll be 30 in January. He looks nice, she says. Is he nice? Laurel puts the wine in the fridge and turns back to Poppy. He's... Well, yes. He's very nice. I don't really see much of him these days, unfortunately. He lives in Devon. Has he got a girlfriend? Yes. She's called Blue, and they live together in a little gingerbread cottage with chickens in the garden. He's a surveyor. I'm not sure what she does. Something to do with knitting, I think. Do you like her? It sounds as if you don't like her. Laurel and Floyd exchange another look. She's waiting for him to pull Poppy back a bit, rein her in. But he doesn't. He watches her in something approaching awe, as though waiting to see just how far she will go. I barely know her, Laurel says, trying to soften her tone. She seems perfectly okay. A bit, maybe, controlling. She shrugs. Jake's a grown man, though. If he wants to be controlled by another human being, I guess that's his lookout. She invites them to sit down and eat some crisps. Floyd does so, but Poppy is still stalking the room, investigating. Have you got a picture of your husband? She says. Ex-husband, Laurel corrects. And no, not on display, but somewhere, I'm sure. What's his name? Paul. Poppy nods. What's he like? She smiles at Floyd, looking to be rescued, but he looks as keen to find out about Paul as his daughter. Oh, she says. Paul? He's lovely, actually. He's a really lovely man. Very gentle. Very kind. A bit daft. Then why did you split up? Ah. There it was. Silly her not to have seen the conversation cul-de-sac she was walking straight into. And still, Floyd does not come to her rescue. Simply scoops some dip onto a pita chip and pops it into his mouth. We changed,
We wanted different things. The children grew up and left home, and we realized we didn't want to spend the rest of our lives together.
Did he marry someone else?
No, not quite. But he has a girlfriend. They live together.
Is she nice? Do you like her?
I've never met her, but my children have. They say she's very sweet.
Poppy finally seems sated and takes a seat next to her father, who grips her knee and gives it a quick, hard squeeze as if to say, "Good job on grilling the lady." Then he leans toward the coffee table and places a hand on the neck of the carver and says,
"Well, shall I?"
"Yes, please. How did you get here? Are you driving?"
"No. We got the tube. Do you have an extra glass?"
She's confused for a moment, and then realizes that he wants the extra glass for Poppy.
"Oh," she says. "Sorry, I didn't think. It's the French way, isn't it?"
"What's the French way?"
asks Poppy.
"Children drinking," she explains. "Not something that happens much in other countries."
"Only champagne," says Floyd. "Only a sip. And only on very special occasions."
Laurel pours the carver, and they make a toast to themselves, and to her, and to SJ, for not showing up, and meaning that Poppy gets to stay up late and wear her nice dress.
"That is a really lovely dress," Laurel says, sensing an opening. "Who takes you shopping for clothes?"
"Dad," she replies. "We shop online together mostly, but sometimes we go to Oxford Street."
"And what's your favourite clothes shop?"
"I haven't really got one. Marks and Spencer's is really good, I suppose, and we always go into John Lewis."
"What about H&M? Gap?"
"I'm not really that kind of girl," she says. "Jeans and hoodies and stuff. I like to look smart."
Floyd's hand goes to the knee again, gives it another encouraging, "That's my girl," squeeze.
"So," says Laurel, "tell me about the homeschooling. How does that work?"
"Just like real schooling," Poppy responds. "I sit and learn, and then when I've learned, I relax."
"How many hours a day do you study?"
2 or 3, she says. "Well, 2 or 3 hours with Dad. Obviously, he has to work. The rest of the time by myself."
"And you don't ever get lonely? Or wish you had kids your own age to hang out with?"
"No,"
she says, shaking her head emphatically.
"No, no, never."
"Poppy is basically 40 years old, says Floyd admiringly. "You know how you get to 40 and you suddenly stop giving a shit about all the stupid things you worried about your whole life? Well, Poppy's already there."
"When I'm with kids my own age, I tend to roll my eyes a lot and look at them like they're mad, which doesn't really go down too well. They think I'm a bitch."
Poppy shrugs and laughs and takes a mouthful of champagne.
Laurel simply nods. She can see how this self-possessed child might appear to other children, but she doesn't believe that it's the way it must be. She doesn't believe that Poppy couldn't learn to enjoy time with her peers, to stop rolling her eyes at them and alienating them.
She doesn't know, thinks Laurel. She doesn't know that this isn't how you grow up, that wearing shiny shoes with bows on and rolling your eyes at other kids is not a sign of maturity, but a sign that you've missed a whole set of steps on the road to maturity. This child, Laurel suddenly feels with the immediacy of a kick to the gut, needs a mother. And this mother, she acknowledges, needs a child. And Poppy, she is so like Ellie. The planes and lines of her pretty face, the shape of her hairline, of her skull, the way her ears attach to her head, the shapes her mouth makes when it moves,
the precise angle of her Cupid's bow. They're almost mathematically identical. The differences are pronounced, too. Her eyebrows are thicker. Her neck is longer. Her hair parts differently and is a different shade of brown. And while Ellie's eyes were a hazel brown, Poppy's are chocolate. They are not identical. But there is something. Something alarming and arresting. A likeness that she can't leave alone. "Maybe you and I could go shopping together," Laurel says brightly. "One day? Would you like that?" Finally, Poppy looks to her dad for his approval, before turning back to Laurel and saying,
"I would absolutely love that. Yes, please."
Laurel goes to work on Friday. She works Mondays, Tuesdays and Fridays at the shopping center near her flat. Her job title is Marketing Coordinator. It's a silly job. A mum job. A little local thing to fill some hours and make some money to pay for clothes and the like. She comes, she smiles, she makes the phone calls and writes the emails, and sits in the meetings about the inconsequential things she's being paid to pretend she cares about. And then she goes home and doesn't think of any of it again until the next time she walks through the door. But she's glad to be there today. She's happy to be surrounded by familiar people who like her and know her, even if it's only on a superficial level. The previous evening had been strange and unsettling, and she'd awoken thinking that maybe she'd dreamed it. Her flat had felt odd in the wake of her dinner guests, as though it didn't really belong to her. The cushions on the sofa were in the wrong order, the result of Poppy's attempt to tidy up after themselves. Food was stacked in the wrong parts of the fridge, and there was a pile of washing up on the draining board that Poppy had insisted on doing, in spite of Laurel trying to persuade her that she needn't, that it would all just go in the dishwasher. The lilies on the dining table gave off a strange, deathly perfume, and Floyd had left his scarf in her hallway, a soft grey thing with a Ted Baker label in it that hung from a hook like a plume of dark smoke. She'd been glad to leave the flat, to put some distance between last night and herself. But even as she switches on her computer and stirs sweeteners into her coffee, as she listens to the messages on her voicemail, it's there, like a dark echo. Something not right. Something to do with Floyd and Poppy. She can't pin it down. Poppy is clearly a strange child, who is both charmingly naive and unsettlingly self-possessed. She is cleverer than she has any need to be, but also not as clever as she thinks. And Floyd, who in the time that Laurel has spent alone with him is virtually perfect, warps into something altogether more complicated when he's with his daughter. Laurel finally crystallizes the issue while discussing her evening with her colleague, Helen. "It was like," she says, "you know, like when you're supposed to be having drinks with a friend, and they bring their partner along and suddenly you're at the pointy end of a triangle." The evening had essentially been the Floyd and Poppy show, with Poppy as the star turn, and Laurel as the slightly dumbfounded audience of one. Floyd and Poppy shared the same sense of humour, and lined up jokes for each other. And Floyd's eyes were always on his precocious child, sparkling with wonder and pride. There was not one conversation that had not involved Poppy and her opinions, and there had not been one moment during which Laurel had felt more important, special, or interesting than her. She'd closed the door on them at midnight, feeling drained and somewhat dazed.
"Sounds like she's got the classic only child syndrome," says Helen, neatly shrinking the issue down to a digestible bite-sized chunk of common sense. "Plus, you know, some fathers and daughters just have that sort of thing, don't they? Daddy's girls. They usually turn into the sort of women who can only be friends with men."
Laurel nods gratefully. "Yes, that all makes perfect sense. She has seen that bond before between fathers and daughters. Not with her own daughters, Ellie was both a mummy's and a daddy's girl, and Hannah is just a lore unto herself. And maybe the surprise she's feeling is due to her own issues, and nothing to do with Floyd and Poppy. Poppy is entertaining in a gauche kind of way, and Floyd is clearly a wonderful, nurturing, and loving father. By the time Laurel leaves the office at 5:30 and gets into her car in the underground car park, she is feeling clear-headed and right-footed. She cannot wait to see Floyd again. Laurel and Floyd spend the whole of the following weekend together. It wasn't planned that way, but there never seemed to be a point at which leaving his house made any sense. They had dinner out on Friday night, a late breakfast on Saturday morning, a trip to the cinema with Poppy that afternoon, followed by a detour to M&S for new underwear and a toothbrush, Chinese takeout on Saturday night, and then brunch in a cafe around the corner on Sunday, before Laurel managed to tear herself away and back to her flat on Sunday evening, ready for work on Monday morning. At the office, Laurel feels as though she has shed a skin, that she is somehow reborn, and that she needs to mark the transition in some landmark way. She calls Hannah. "How would you feel?" she starts, tentatively. "If I invited my new boyfriend to our birthday dinner?" The silence is black and heavy. Laurel fills it. "Totally don't mind if you say no. Totally understand. I just thought, in the spirit of us all moving on, in the spirit of a brave new world..." The silence continues, growing in depth and darkness. "Boyfriend," says Hannah, eventually. "Since when did you have a boyfriend?"
"The guy," says Laurel. "The guy I told you about? Floyd?"
"I know the guy," she replies. "I just wasn't aware that he'd made a boyfriend status."
"Yes. Well, if you ever answered your phone..."
Hannah sighs. Laurel sighs too, realizing she has just done the thing she always promised herself she would never do. When the children were small, Laurel's mother would occasionally make small, raw observations about gaps between phone calls and visits that would tear tiny, painful strips off Laurel's conscience. "I will never guilt-trip my children when they are adults," she'd vowed. "I will never expect more than they are able to give."
"Sorry," she says. "I didn't mean to nag, it's just... yes, things are moving quite fast. I've met his kids. I've stayed at his. We talk all the time. We've just spent the whole weekend together, I just..."
"Ridiculous," she suddenly realizes. "A ridiculous idea. But forget I mentioned it. I mean, I haven't even asked Floyd yet if he'd like to come. He'd probably rather saw his legs off. Forget I said anything." There's another silence. Softer this time.
"Whatever," Hannah says. "Invite him. I don't mind. If it's going to be so fucked up anyway, we may as well go the whole hog."
Floyd says yes. Of course Floyd says yes. Floyd has made it very clear from the moment she headed home after their second date that he is wholly committed to their romance and that he is not interested in playing games or hard to get.
"I would love that," he says. "As long as your family are okay with it."
Paul had been okay about it. Hugely surprised, but okay. Jake had said it was fine. No one was jumping up and down about it, but no one had said it was a mistake.
"And Poppy?"
Laurel adds. "Would Poppy like to come too?"
She half hopes he'll say no. "She'll be thrilled," Floyd says. "She keeps saying how much she'd like to meet your children."
"And my ex-husband. And my ex-husband's girlfriend."
"The whole shebang. The whole shebang. The whole hog."
She books a table for 8 at a restaurant in Islington.
a legendarily shishi place down a narrow cobbled alleyway off Upper Street.